This is Changemakers with Katie Gore, finding the right solutions for the affordable housing community.
Welcome back to my talk with Carol Naughton, the CEO of Purpose Built Communities, an organization that supports the transformation of under-resourced neighborhoods into vibrant and healthy places. We've been talking about how her team collaborates with local leaders to develop comprehensive solutions that tackle the underlying issues of poverty and injustice. So, Carol, your work at Purpose Built is very much centered around the neighborhoods you work in. How do you balance the history and legacy of a neighborhood with the desire for improvement and change? Can you share some specific strategies and examples?
So I think the most important thing that we have discovered over the last 12 years is that we need to center resident voice and resident power in this work. And while I think a lot of our network members have done that instinctively, we had not called it out in our model as clearly until about a year and a half ago. And so centering resident voice and power, particularly the voice and power of people who already live in the neighborhood, right? To make sure that their voice is heard and that they are part of the planning process. So the improvements to the neighborhood feel like they're owned, right? That they met the needs of the people who lived here and said, this is what I want to see in my neighborhood. And so that really authentic process, that centering the voice of legacy residents, really working with legacy residents on developing the plan and what we have internally, we call kind of racial equity choice points, knowing along this process that there are going to be a number of decisions that have to be made. How do we make sure that our network members and their partners and the community are aware of these choice points and that being prepared to use a racial equity lens in developing the plan and executing the plan, including the choice points, is going to create a neighborhood where the people who live there already feel even more ownership and more sense of pride in it.
One of the things you mentioned as your strategic priority, which is really unique, and I want to highlight this, is this emphasis on mixed income housing rather than focusing exclusively on low income housing. So what is the return on this investment looking like? And maybe explain why this is even part of your approach and your philosophy.
So I am a true believer in the power of delivering affordable housing in a mixed income model. I think affordable housing should always be delivered in a mixed income model, that we should not be isolating or marginalizing and warehousing people based on their income. I'm really clear about that. And there are a variety of reasons. So we think with our comprehensive neighborhood strategy that people aren't going to be poor forever. And if you don't create a housing continuum in a neighborhood that will serve people at different income points and have different products that people need at different times in their life, the neighborhood won't be competitive for them. And so, as I said earlier, you know, the idea that if people have some change in their pocket and you only have low-income housing in the neighborhood, then they by definition have to leave because they're no longer qualified to live there. And we don't want to force people to leave. We want to compete for people so they want to stay. So number one, we don't believe people can or should be poor forever. We think that there are lots of things that neighbors and partners can do to improve people's incomes over time and that housing stock should be reflective of that. We also know that it's important to be able to attract other investment into neighborhoods. Most of the places where we're invited to work don't have grocery stores when we're invited. And part of the reason they don't have grocery stores is because there's both a lack of density of housing and not enough folks with expendable income in order to make it worth a for-profit grocery store's investment in that neighborhood. And so increasing the number of folks who live there and including having some folks with expendable income will help attract other investment to the community that will benefit everybody, most particularly the low-income families who've never had access, for example, to a great grocery store. But this might be the most important reason. And this is a result of research by a guy named Raj Chetty, who's an economist at Harvard. And he's looked at lots of connections between place and economic mobility. And I'd encourage you and your listeners to take a look at at his research, first was able to determine that where you lived, where you grew up, could predict your likelihood of moving up in the world in the socioeconomic status. And in fact, 10 years ago or so, his first research showed that if you grew up in a low-income neighborhood in Atlanta, your likelihood of moving from the bottom 20% of the economic food chain to the top 20% during your lifetime was only 4.3% chance.
Oh, right? My gosh. Wow.
And so, he was the first person who codified and could prove what we had all observed, right? Mm-hmm. That neighborhood matters, place matters. Then he did additional research that showed that the half a mile range around where a 10-year-old lives is critically important for that 10-year-old's life prospects. And the most recent research, this is what I'm really excited about. He looked at social capital and said, how important is social capital in helping lower income families be able to move up the economic food chain? And what he determined, looking at the big data that his team looks at, is that economic connectedness, which he defined as friendships across economic levels, was the single most important predictor of whether a low-income person was going to become a higher-income person in their lifetime. So mixed-income housing is a critical way of creating opportunities for those friendships to develop, those cross-economic friendships. And because so many schools are designed to serve neighborhoods, that if you don't create a mixed income neighborhood, you don't have a mixed income school. And you don't create those opportunities for kids and their parents to build authentic relationships and friendships with people across the income strata. So to me, you know, that research is affirmation that delivering affordable housing in a mixed income model, creating mixed income models is a really important strategy in terms of creating a society where economic mobility is more broadly shared.
I completely see why you guys have been described as the convener and catalyst for social change, because it is a really comprehensive approach to neighborhood revitalization. What a great way for neighborhoods to get organized and try to pursue that mobility and success dynamic. On the flip side, what is the major obstacle that when you guys come in, what do you hear from a community?
So I think there are a couple of things that people are always concerned about when we're invited to a community, and folks have lots of genuine concern about the idea of gentrification, which is this big idea of people of a different race and income coming into a neighborhood and pushing out the people who've lived there who are usually black or brown. And the neighborhood becomes very different in terms of character. We're working to try and improve the neighborhood, to transform the neighborhood without transplanting the people, right? So by centering resident voice and power in this work from the beginning, it makes a really big difference. So people who live there today, legacy residents, will recognize their neighborhood in how it feels 10 years from now, even if it looks very different because there's new infrastructure in the neighborhood, new housing, new schools, new opportunities in the community, but they will see it as theirs. The other thing that I think is important to think about here is it's really hard to have conversations around race in our country. And we've worked really hard to figure out how we can create new language and new opportunities to talk about poverty and place in ways that don't get everybody to dig their heels in and not see themselves as having a role in this conversation. We just released a new body of work that we call Where We Thrive, which was a project that we did along with the Frameworks Institute to look at, are there better ways to talk about race, place, and poverty in a way that bring more people to the table, as opposed to creating circumstances where people just dig their heels in and say, you know, oh, this is too woke, or this is that, or whatever. And we're really excited about some of the ways that we're able to frame conversations now. And I'd encourage folks to take a look at our website under Where We Thrive. There's some really good tools to use to start to have conversations so that we can set a broader table and get more people into this work. Because our experience shows us that regardless of whether somebody identifies as red or blue, they love their community and they want to work together to improve it. And if we can create language and opportunity for people to find those partnerships a little bit easily, more easily, that will benefit not just this work, but lots of work.
Speaking of partnerships, one really unique one you have amongst many is the Truist Foundation Racial Equity Ambassadors Program. Tell us more about that, because it's a great exhibit A, so to speak, of what you just said.
We're really excited about the Truist Foundation Racial Equity Ambassadors Program. Back in, I think it was back around 2015 or 2016, we started doing kind of our own deep dive on racial equity and worked with a couple of great consultants, Race Forward and others, to really start to build our own muscles and our comfort around what does racial equity mean? How does it impact how we do our work? How do we communicate with other folks? And when my colleague Michelle Matthews joined us, I think in 2017, she really brought a focus to racial equity in our work, and we created an ambassadors program, which we could bring network members, staff to engage in like a year-long process of diving deep into racial equity and what does it mean? How does it impact their work? How does it impact how they relate to people in community? And really become expert practitioners who've really built these great racial equity muscles. And in 2020, the Truist Foundation invested in us and allowed us to really increase the number of folks who participate in that program and move forward. So we're now in our third cohort of Truist Foundation Racial Equity Ambassadors. Again, folks who do a deep dive into understanding what this means and how it impacts their work and how it impacts their role as leaders in the community. So I'm really excited about this. I hope this is something that we'll be able to continue for many years to come. There's a lot of hunger and energy in our network around building these muscles, and this has been a great way to do that.
You guys are really tackling several complex dynamics here on your platform and how you deliver this community revitalization. And, you know, we've covered mixed income, we've covered the racial gentrification, neighborhood fabric portions of this. Highlight for me now this health and wellness amenities, because it is something we all probably instinctually know when it comes to incomes and communities and access, but drive it home for us a little bit more.
Thank you for asking that. This is, I have to tell a story on myself here. I was one of those people who conflated access to healthcare with health. And my former colleague, Shirley Franklin, who is our executive board chair, the former mayor of Atlanta, she'd come back from meetings with Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Commission on Building a Healthier America and would drop report after report after report on my desk. And I'd finally sit down and read them. And it was like this, you know, the scales fell from my eyes to realize that, you know, health is what happens outside the doctor's office, right? Access to healthcare, of course, is important. But there are so many things that happen in people's lives and conditions in which they live that have an even greater impact on their health that we needed to understand more about that. I was connected with a guy in San Francisco named Dr. Doug Judy, who had just started an organization called the Build Healthy Places Network. He was a pediatrician and master's in public health, and I'd been connected with him as somebody who might help me understand how do we think about health at a neighborhood level. And so I'm really in the beginning of my journey on this. And I asked Doug, said, well, how do we know? You know, we look at health and do we know until, you know, 80 years from now, how long somebody's lived, what the quality of their life has been, what are the early measures to know whether a child, a family, a community, for example, are on track for a good health outcome? And he looked at him without missing a beat. He said, oh, that's easy. Third grade reading scores. And that was, again, a huge aha in my education in this space, that all these things are connected and that we needed to be thinking about how do we move upstream from the doctor's office to impact those things that we call the social determinants of health. which are the kinds of things that impact health outside the doctor's office. And we realized that as community developers, we were already doing most of them. We just didn't appreciate that in addition to providing great housing, mixed income housing was going to be one of those social determinants of health that would make a difference in somebody's health outcome down the road. We didn't appreciate that access to high quality early learning was likely to improve the quality of somebody's life from a health perspective for the rest of their lives. So it really helped us understand the connective tissue between health, upstream interventions, and the kinds of work that we do as community developers.
This is fascinating because it is, we could say this is comprehensive, but this truly is one of the unique indicators about the fabric of a neighborhood being able to grow within, isn't it?
It is. And, all this stuff, it's great as, Jack Shonkoff, who's at the Center for the Developing Child at Harvard, and is really one of the leading scientists and thought leaders on the connection between place and health. Jack says it's great when science and what your grandmother told you all align.
And I
think this is one of those places that you can look at a place and kind of know intuitively very quickly whether the people who live here are going to have great health outcomes or not. You don't have to have a PhD to be able to understand that. But we haven't put all that together from a societal way. We haven't thought about, well, if we invest in communities, how do we calculate a return on investment for all of these opportunities? So if you invest in housing, you invest in education, you invest in early learning, what is the return on investment down the road for our society? And part of the challenge is that those investments pay off in other people's pockets, right? All different parts of the government, all different parts of taxpayers' investments, and in some private sector and some other public sector places. So we don't have a great way to quantify it yet. And there's some great folks working on how can we do that. So we know now, for example, if you invest in high quality early learning, we know there's like a $7 to $12 return on investment simply from that one intervention. Think about what the return on investment should be for all of this. We had a group at University of Georgia, the business school, the Terry School of Business, the Seelig Center, took a look at the investment in Eastlake and determined that all of that investment, all of those, millions of dollars that were spent basically were paid back in just 18 months of operating the community. So, I mean, there's huge return on investment, and we've got to continue to find ways to tell that story because this is a great bargain for people who are looking for return on investment, both from a social standpoint and from a taxpayer standpoint.
And this translates into everything from infrastructure. You know, you're talking about sidewalks, mm-hmm. parks, healthy living and those pieces of it, to not just the access to, health clinics and things like that. But I mean, like, this just ripples to every piece of the community, doesn't it?
It really does. I'm so glad you mentioned things like sidewalks, right? I was driving through the Eastlake neighborhood yesterday with a group in from New York City. And I just happened to point out and said, look, there's sidewalks everywhere here, really nice sidewalks, wide, with our setback a little bit from the street. So it feels like, you could have kids walking to school here every day and they'd feel safe and they're well lit when it gets dark out. But thinking about how you make those investments on the front end, when you're planning for a new investment, when you're planning for a public housing revitalization, or when you're planning a new apartment complex or a new investment in a neighborhood, be thinking about those things down the road. The challenge is, I think for real estate developers, they can only control what they control, right, on their site that they own. But there's all this other space, that the neighborhood space, that some of it is public sector space and some of it is space that hasn't been developed, but having a comprehensive plan that says, we are going to work to not just do what a developer can do on the piece that that developer might control, but we're going to make sure that the whole neighborhood is well lit. We're going to make sure that there are good sidewalks that run through the whole neighborhood so people can get out and take walks, that kids can walk to school. All those things make a difference.
Carol, this has been an amazing conversation, and we really applaud all the pathways to prosperity you're doing for every single one of these communities. Last question here as we wrap up. What does this mean now for you personally, and really even for your child that brought you to this moment of enlightenment, to today? I mean, just share from your heart now, because you've got like the best job in the world. So,
and it's a really hard job. So
it's very complex. I mean, like every single one of these pieces are so difficult, but it's like you're doing the right things for the right reasons. So just share what that means for you.
Well, thank you for that question. I think this work is incredibly important. I think the leaders that we are seeing working at the neighborhood level in our network across the country are extraordinary. One of my board members calls them wildly impressive. And they are. They could be doing anything in the world. They could be working at a regional level. They could be working at a federal level. They choose to work at a neighborhood level because that's where they can really make a difference and see change within a few years. I am sustained by this work because of the quality of the folks that I get to work with, both at Purpose Built, the quality of the folks I get to work with at the neighborhood level across our network, the partners that we are developing across the country, because I think the work that we do is an incredibly important part of the solution of creating an America that meets kind of the aspirations of our founding fathers, creating an America where economic mobility is more broadly shared, where we can all become who we're supposed to become, where we all thrive. And that's what sustains me. And that's a really exciting place to be at this point in my career.
Carol, thank you for taking the time. This has been an amazing conversation. Godspeed as you keep doing what you're doing in all of these communities and even more. So thank you for being here.
Thanks, Katie. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks for listening to Changemakers with Katie Gore. To find out more about Katie, go to quadel.com. That's QUADEL.com. This has been a production of Forbes Books Radio.